Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines, with 4,000 flights to 250 cities in some 40 countries around the world every day. It's easy to book your next flight at AA.com. American Airlines knows why you fly. I'm Rick Steves, and this is Travel with Rick Steves. And right now we're traveling to one of my favorite corners of Europe, Ireland. A great thing about Ireland is not its thunderous, earth-shaking sights as much as, I think, the friendliest people you'll find anywhere in your travels. And a great thing about Ireland for me is I can understand the language. Wonderful accents, but I still get the sense that I'm understanding a foreign language, but I can hear it loud and clear. And that lets me tap into one of the wonders of Ireland, their wonderful gift of gab. I've got with me a man who leads tours for me all over Ireland. He lives up in Derry, and his name is Stephen McPhillamy. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure, Rick. Chia ditch. That means God be on you.
God be on me. Chia ditch.
And the response to that is Gia Moradich. God and Mary be on you.
Really?
That's the response.
Gia Moradich.
Except in Kerry, where they say Gia Mora August Patrick ditch, which means God, Mary, and St. Patrick be back on you. So it's a bit longer.
When you're thinking about Ireland, it's a complete island with two different political zones. And I really don't think a trip to Ireland is complete without seeing both zones. You've got to see the Republic of Ireland, and that's where most of the famous places that we all think of when we think about Ireland are located. But really, no trip to Ireland is complete without including Northern Ireland. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Let's just give people an introduction to Northern Ireland, because I think there's a little confusion. Give me a quick geographic overview of the island.
Northern Ireland is the northeast of the island. We have six counties out of 32. So I think roughly we've got about 20% of the island, the landmass. Ireland's not very big, 3 hours east to west and 6 hours drive north to south. So Northern Ireland, not a very big place, but we've got 1.5 million people. The population of the whole island is around 5. So we're fairly densely populated in Irish terms.
20% of the land, a third of the population.
Yeah.
Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, do you say? Or?
Yeah, we are an integral part of the United Kingdom.
Okay.
If you watch the Olympic Games, for example, the British team is called GBNI, the team of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
Okay, so Great Britain is...
Is Scotland, England and Wales.
That's the island?
That's
the island,
actually. And when they join Northern Ireland together, we're the United Kingdom.
Now, Ulster, we hear the word Ulster. Technically, that's not the same as Northern Ireland.
Not exactly. Ulster is my sort of beloved ancient northern province. There's four provinces in Ireland. Leinster in the east, Connacht in the west, Munster in the south, and then Ulster in the north. Ulster's 9 counties. But in 1919, the IRA were fighting the British Army in a war of independence, which lasted until 1921. 400 years ago, if you had come to Ireland on your travels, it was entirely Catholic, entirely Gaelic. The English began to conquer the Southern Irish very easily because they didn't stick together. The clans there didn't come together. In the north of Ireland, the clans did come together. So it took the English 9 years to conquer.
Really? So the Northern Ireland was really the most
militarily,
cohesively
exactly.
Catholic.
And
zone.
Militarily extremely powerful. You had two big clans up there, one called the O'Donnells and one called the O'Neills. And they often fought just like the MacDonalds and the Campbells in Scotland and the Hatfields and the McCoys here down in the southern states. But these guys stuck together when the English arrived. So the English came in and they fought us from 1592 to 1601. It's called the 9 Years' War. And it became like the Vietnam of Britain's Vietnam of the 16th century.
Really?
The English army came in and it got stuck and it couldn't get back out. Queen Elizabeth was scared that the Spanish, who were her big enemy at the time, were going to come to the north of Ireland and use it as a base to launch an attack on England. Or maybe go over to Scotland from Northern Ireland, which is only 12 miles away. And, you know, the Scottish have never needed any excuse to launch attacks in England. So that would have been England's Achilles heel,
wow.
Northern Ireland. So they put a lot of effort into the conquering.
So the English really wanted to control the north of Ireland because that was the heartland of the Irish clans.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they fought us with massive resources. However, we beat them nearly every battle we fought them. The only problem was the Irish armies were very strong. They were trained by Imperial Spain. Spanish officers would come and help us. But we only fought in the summer. War was not a winter pastime. Winter's when we would go off and celebrate our victories and create a new generation and just have music and songs and laments and whatever else. But towards the end of the war, the English began fighting us in the winter. And we didn't want that. Towards the end of the war as well, our men were becoming tired of war. We just hoped the English would just go away and leave us alone. They also started cutting our forests down. We had a guerrilla army that sort of fought from the forests, and as we lost cover, we were in trouble.
Is that right?
If we fought the English in open battle, we were in serious trouble. If we got them in the forests, we were like little sort of
ninjas. So obviously the English had a lot more manpower and wealth to fight the Irish with. So the English controlled the island, and then there was the
age-old problem of the English Protestants controlling the Catholic Irish, and it worked up to a war for independence.
Yeah, just going back to the 9 Years' War, the conclusion of that was once the English had conquered the north, they brought over thousands of Protestants from England and from Scotland. They wanted to bring English Anglicans, but couldn't really attract them to come, so they got lowland Scottish Presbyterians instead. Very tough, very hardy, very industrious people. Then in 1919, IRA began to fight the British Army, fought them to a standstill in 1921, and the British offered to withdraw from about 80% of Ireland. And the IRA accepted that and they became the government. Reluctantly accepted that. There was a civil war as a result.
Ireland wins its independence from Britain. And then the Irish have a plebiscite. And then people in the north decide to stay with England because they are mostly Protestant.
Well, basically what happened was Britain probably would have preferred to hand all of Ireland over to an Irish government. But Protestants in the northeast were reluctant to go with this idea because they said that home rule would be Rome rule. They'd be ruled from Rome by the Pope and that it would be an Irish Catholic dominated society and they wanted to stay with London.
Home rule would be Rome rule. Okay, I didn't know that.
So Britain decided to keep them because of the sacrifices that they had made for Britain in the bloodbaths and the trenches of World War I.
I've got Stephen McPhillamy with me here and we're going to talk about his part of Ireland, Northern Ireland. Thanks, Stephen, for being with us.
You're very welcome, Rick.
Everybody knows about Dublin and Ring of Kerry and Donegal and so on. But what are the highlights for sightseeing in North Ireland?
Well, the highlights are many. We have Belfast, which is the second biggest city on the island. City centre is quite cosmopolitan, quite beautiful, architecturally splendid. It was once the second richest city in the British Empire, second only to London.
So it boomed during the Industrial Age.
Absolutely. I mean, we had the biggest steelworks and ironworks.
Made the Titanic there.
Titanic wouldn't be the greatest advertisement for Belfast shipbuilding. But
that's just, what, a couple of hours from Dublin by the express train now?
Yeah, about just over 2 hours. We've got a new north-south link now. The two governments, as part of the peace process, have built a new road linking Belfast and Dublin.
Wow.
So, you know, it's going very well there. It's great access to each city.
From Belfast, you go just a couple hours north and you find yourself on the Antrim coast.
Yeah, just about an hour and a half north. We've got one of the most beautiful stretches of coastline anywhere in Europe. We've got one of the greatest touring days in the world, in my opinion. You've got the Glens of Antrim, which the English travel writer Thackeray once described as Switzerland in miniature.
Switzerland in miniature.
9 glorious glens sweeping down into the
What's
sea.
What's a glen now?
Glen is the Gaelic word for a valley
that
okay. can often access the sea.
Great golfing up there?
Great golf. Royal Portrush, Royal County Down, two of the finest golf courses in Ireland. We have Dunluce Castle, ancestral home of the MacDonald clan, not the Scottish MacDonalds, but the Irish MacDonnells. We have a very famous rope bridge.
Oh,
For the more sort of...
With a natural preserve there, lots of bird watching.
Absolutely, yeah, one of the greatest...
And when you think about the golfing, what is it, what's the name of the kind of golf course that's right where the sand dunes hit the shore?
That's called Royal Portrush.
Portrush, yeah.
One of the resident professionals there was Darren Clark, one of Europe's top golfers.
Now, also, in the north of Ireland, you've got Giant's Causeway, one of the most visited places in all of Britain, I think.
That's our pride and joy. The Giant's Causeway is a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And it's about 60,000 sort of basalt hexagonal columns.
So these, what, six-sided columns? Is that what hexagonal is?
Yeah.
And then you've got, they all look like, to me it looks like somebody's offering a pack of cigarettes to God almost. I mean,
cool.
There's a thousand little cigarettes that poke up, all six-sided. And you can walk them like stepping stones. The geologists have this goofy idea that it's sort of a...
By violent volcanic eruptions.
But I know that's nobody buys
that. Many millions of years ago. I'd say until fairly recently, everyone in Ireland, and especially up around the coast, believed that this was built by giants. We used to have a giant called Finn McCool. Finn's the Gaelic word
for blood. So this is the alternative to the scientific explanation.
And it's also what a lot of people genuinely would believe. You know, grandkids are going down there with their grandparents and asking, what is this thing? And they're telling, the only explanation would be that it's built by giants.
These stepping stone rocks going into the sea from Northern Ireland, and then 12 miles later, they come out of the sea and you're in Scotland.
In Scotland, in a Scottish island called Staffa. Well, you had a giant called Finn McCool, and the Scottish had a bigger one called Rory Ben and Dunner. And he decided to come across and conquer us. He didn't come by boat, however. He decided to build this causeway of stones and got his stonemasons to build it. So as he's coming across, Finn McCool, the Irish giant, knew he'd have to fight him because the Celts fought champion to champion. So he was a bit scared, I suppose, and his wife Una decided she'd have a cunning plan. She dressed him up as a baby, made a cradle that was about 6'2" or 6'4" long. And this is Ulster's hardest man. She wrapped him up in Irish linen and put him inside. And when the Scottish giant came over, after 2 days of plundering and raping and pillaging, he finally got inside, grabbed Finn McCool's wife and said, "I'm going to kill your husband and I'm going to kill you. Where is your husband?" And she basically looked at him and said, "Shh, if you don't be quiet, you're going to wake my baby. And if you wake my baby when his father comes back from hunting, he'll be extremely angry. And the Scottish giant turned around and was terrified because the baby was 6'4" long. And thought, well, if that's the baby, the father's going to be 40 feet high. And basically ran the whole way back to Scotland, pulling the giant's causeway up and dumping it in the sea so this brave Irish giant wouldn't be able to follow him back. And that's how what we believe the giant's causeway and how the giant's causeway was built.
And Ireland is drenched with that kind of myth mixed with history, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the basis of our culture.
Now, today we still have the split Ireland. It's an ongoing problem, but things are getting better, I think. But let's just talk terminology here. You've got then loyalists, unionists, republicans, nationalists. It's so confusing to the tourist. What do all these terms mean when you're traveling?
Well, basically, there's two communities in Northern Ireland. Around 56% of us are Protestants by faith. We are loyalist, meaning we're loyal to the Queen. Mm-hmm. And we're also unionists, meaning that we want to maintain the union between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, which is the United Kingdom.
Those are the Protestants. And I didn't realize it was only 56%.
That's the recent figures, yeah.
Interesting. Has that been changing?
Catholics have a much higher birth rate there.
In the Catholic community, that would be 40-some percent.
Yeah, we have around 44% of us are Catholics. And those of us who are Catholic identify with the Republic of Ireland or identify with Ireland in general. We see ourselves as Irish. We are nationalist in the sense that we are Irish nationalists. We want the Irish nation and culture to be recognised. And we're also Republicans, meaning we don't really want to go, or not at all, want to go with the concept of a monarchy. We want to be a republic, North and South, joined together.
So virtually half of North Ireland is Catholic. Would you say it's fair to say that all Catholics in the North would prefer to be part of the republic?
That's the general feeling.
The vast majority.
To be Catholic is to be nationalist, and to be Protestant is to be unionist.
Now, when you travel a day, you see some remnants of the troubles, the difficult times in the North as they sort out their political problems. You see bonfires, you see orange parades. Tell me a little bit about the bonfires and the orange parades.
Well, on the 12th of July, 1690, the Protestant armies of King William of Orange defeated the Catholic armies of King James II, and that's basically Catholic power in Ireland vanquished forever. So the Protestant community in the North likes to celebrate that through its marching season, which starts on Easter Monday and ends on the first Sunday in September. Like, you would have baseball season here or basketball season in Northern Ireland. We have to have the marching season, which is kind of an ironic situation.
Celebrating a battle from how long ago?
1690.
And it's basically a way for the Protestants to sort of rub their Catholic neighbors' noses in their defeat, kind of.
Protestants love the marches, obviously, and Catholics don't like to be reminded that they're beaten. Airline pilots used to have a joke flying into Belfast where they would tell their passengers that they'd set their watches to local time, which was 1690.
Oh, my goodness. Now, there's hundreds of orange parades all over the North. Most of them are peaceful. The ones that are antagonistic are the ones that are pointedly going through Catholic neighborhoods.
About 92% of the marches pass off peacefully, and you're talking several thousand marches there. Me and your good self observed one in Portrush two summers ago, and there was no problem. Generally, the marching issue is settling down now, but they can be antagonistic to the Catholic community. You'd often have hangers-on. The actual Orange Men, which is a Protestant secret society, who would march, don't necessarily maybe be very provocative themselves, but a lot of their hangers-on. You'll get a lot of skinheads coming along with the marches. And
the police are there
guys.
trying to keep things orderly.
Aye, and the Catholic community doesn't like to see them coming through their area, so there can be problems, and quite often serious violence as a result.
If you're a tourist looking to really kind of stay out of any sort of trouble, if you see a march, that's probably an area where you might want to be careful.
You need to be careful, yeah. You can use your intelligence and not get involved. You can go along and watch and still have a very interesting, not necessarily enjoyable, but a very interesting cultural experience.
An interesting issue to me is the use of a nation's flag to promote a particular political cause that doesn't represent everybody in the country. I think that's a problem. If I'm against the war in Iraq, I don't like to see my flag being used as a symbol of support for the war in Iraq, because it's everybody's flag, not just one person's flag or one political cause's flag. It's not a logo for a political cause. I feel that way in part because of what I've seen in Northern Ireland. I think 40% of the people in Northern Ireland think of the Union Jack, which is their flag, as something that doesn't represent them. In fact, it's got a nickname,
The Butcher's Apron.
The Butcher's Apron.
The nationalist or the Catholic community. We've been abusing flags in Northern Ireland for many years. The Union Jack is everywhere there in Protestant neighborhoods.
The Catholic population, they look at their country's flag, the Union Jack, and it's not a warm and cozy sight.
No, they don't see it as respecting or representing their allegiance, which is to Ireland, which is to the green, white and orange banner of the South. In Northern Ireland until 1972, we had our own flag, which you'll see as you drive around, the red and white banner with the red hand and the crown on it.
Right.
And in Northern Ireland, that gets the same reaction that the Confederate flag would get here in America.
Is that right?
Some people love it. Many people hate it. Some are indifferent, but it's always a controversy.
I'm talking, by the way, with my friend Stephen McPhillamy, who's Catholic and lives in the north of Ireland, and he takes tours for me around all of Ireland. And Stephen's sharing with us an insight into his corner of the British Isles. Stephen, I was driving through towns in the north, and some towns you don't see many flags, and other towns everything is red, white, and blue, and that's the colors of the Union Jack. It's just like one big British shrine.
Yeah, and I've often brought British tourists around Northern Ireland, ironically, and they feel very uncomfortable in these areas. To many English tourists who come over to Northern Ireland, they see red, white and blue streets and the Union Jack and the murals of the Queen. They don't see that anywhere in Britain. And often in Britain, the Union Jack and displaying of it like that is associated with the far right and sort of National Front and even the small British Nazi Party. In Northern Ireland, the Catholic community and the nationalist cause is generally perceived as left-wing, whereas the loyalist and the Protestant cause is very much to the right. And left-wing causes and separatist causes throughout Europe, they tend to identify with Northern Ireland, the IRA and the nationalist people up there, the Basques, the Catalans. We get Kurds coming over, Palestinians. Mandela was a big supporter of the IRA up in Northern Ireland. So, you know, African nationalism there is on a par also.
It's interesting. I remember when I was in Portrush, I saw an Israeli flag alone on a flagpole in the center of town. When I was in the Catholic neighborhoods of Belfast, I met more Kurds and more Catalonians and Basques than I had met anywhere else outside of their own homeland.
Yeah, it's an interesting development in recent years. And the reason there for the Israeli flag being flown is simply because the Palestinian flag is flown in certain Catholic neighborhoods. Hmm. So the Protestants are thinking, well, if the Catholics are supporting the Palestinians, we have to throw up the Israeli flag. There's no connection between Northern Ireland and the Jewish people of Israel.
There is good news now in Ireland as these two communities are coming together. I've noticed when I'm in Belfast, there's summer camps where kids from both communities are spending weeks together, dancing, playing games, getting away from their parents' sort of cultural baggage. Yeah. Do you see this happening?
I see it a lot. I think there's great positivity there in the future. We've got great initiatives funded by outside sources. America helps us, the American government. We have the Australian government. We have a great thing called the International Fund for Ireland, contributed to by Canada and America and Britain and the European Union. And then the good thing about our peace process is that we have so many international friends. I would hate to be a young kid in Rwanda or somewhere where there's a peace process there where nobody in the world really cares, unfortunately. And we have big, powerful friends because we have sent our people to build big, powerful nations. And they're starting to come back and help us.
Ireland is a much more powerful nation than its, 4 or 5 million people would indicate. How many Irish Americans are there?
The last census, I think, stated 44 million. You know, so with that amount of influence, we have the futures and the potential is endless and limitless for us. We have a brilliant position because we're also very popular in Europe. We're a very popular English-speaking nation in Europe, and the Europeans tend to look to Ireland as good diplomats and good leaders, and we punch way above our weight at the European Union at senior diplomatic level. We're very, very influential there. And being part of the European Union has definitely helped us. We've got investment coming in. We have what's called peace money coming into Northern Ireland, started by the European Commission, which is funding building of tourist projects. We have a new canal even, which joins the River Shannon in the Republic of Ireland with the River Erne in the Northern Ireland. It's called the Shannon-Erne Waterway, a physical, tangible link joining the two parts of the island where cruisers go across.
Is this a recreational canal or an industrial?
This is primarily for recreational purposes, but it's a very strong symbol of North-South cooperation.
And now when you ask the tourist board for information, isn't there one tourist board?
Yeah, it's called Tourism Ireland, marketing Ireland abroad as one destination.
Now, it's safe, it's got a rich history, it's an ongoing struggle. There's no reason not to include Northern Ireland in part of your next Irish adventure, I'd say.
No, anyone going there will find that both communities will welcome them with open arms. Protestants will greet you and welcome you into their homes as one of their family. Catholics will do exactly the same. But again, our only problem is we just don't do that to each other at the moment.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for your insight into your corner of the British Isles.
My pleasure, Rick.
Travel with Rick Steves is brought to you by American Airlines. With their new Advantage Award booking tool, it's easier than ever to book to over 800 Advantage Award destinations online at aa.com. American Airlines knows why you fly.